Oh, the horn. No.
In everything that we do every day, we want to be a champion.
Get your mind right and let's go. Do the little things. Win every day.
It's the same place they play football.
Every team with an attitude.
Alabama. Yes.
I don't give a shit who we're playing.
Dominate the guys you're playing against and make his ass quit. That's our framework. That's our MO as a team.
Richardson breaks free on the sideline. End zone.
This is a mauling, folks, a mauling.
Fear the tide, honey badger.
Hello and welcome to a championship edition of the Alabama Football Podcast. Tom, this one could have gone either way, but fortunately the tide turned our way. You were there in person. What was the difference?
Man, I think this was the tenacity, the pluck and grit, the mental toughness that Saban's been preaching to this team for years. Man, this has to be one of the top five or six most exciting football games I have ever been to. Just the back and forth. It was your heavyweight bout with both teams just knocking the crap out of each other. And just the momentum swings back and forth. And when Georgia blocked that field goal to get down, to return that blocked field goal and go down 11, we've seen many Bama teams pre-Saban that would have just wilted and gone away. And even the national columnists have talked about how there was no panic. They had composure. They kept doing what they were doing. And I even turned to my wife and I said, hey, if we score a touchdown here, it's a four-point game. It'll be like that play never even happened. We scored a touchdown in like 2 minutes. And it's like, okay, we're back to where we were 2 minutes ago.
Yep, that's exactly right. And there were certainly some resilience that demonstrated itself there. That was a critical, you know, and we'll get into special teams, but that was a critical opportunity for Georgia to score points. Both offenses have been really, you know, battling back and forth, you know, with the respective defensive units. And that just seemed like a gimme. That was just a free 7 points that didn't cost really any effort. I mean,
it's a 10-point swing, right?
Sure. You know?
I mean, that's a huge 10 points right there.
Even if they had blocked it and we tackled them, or even if, you know, we had just missed the field goal because it was a 50-yarder and, you know, we're 50% at that. And so it could have been as much of it as a 10-point swing. It certainly was a free 7 points. And in a game as tightly contested as that, for them to get points sort of free like that, I had a little bit, I don't want to say doubt, but I had, you know, if there's going to be a difference in the game, it's going to be that. And, you know, fortunately, it worked out, you know, it worked out differently. And we're all pleased with that. But boy, that was, if there was an opportunity, and I'm circling back to exactly really the point that you made, if there was an opportunity to sort of feel dejected and, you know, tuck tail, that was it. And we have seen teams, we've seen Alabama teams, we've seen us do that to teams when we sit around and just watch football games. That's the type of opportunity that you see, you know, 4 and 5 times a week on any given Saturday, you will see that multiple times, and we battled through.
We did. It was like we say at the beginning of the podcast, you know, Saban talks about break your will and make them quit. Well, Georgia gave us a lot of opportunities there to break our will. But I, you know, going back to the first half for a second, I guess, first of all, just to set up in the Georgia Dome for a second, it was about two-thirds Georgia fans, one-third Bama fans. They really filled the place. It wasn't your 50-50 makeup. We were surrounded by a lot of classy Georgia fans at the beginning of the ball game. Their crowd was really into it. And just to highlight that blocked field goal for a second, when that happened, the lid came off of that place. And so not only was there adversity, but the crowd was in it in a huge way. And Alabama definitely had all the chips stacked against them at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. That is an exciting venue. I'm not a big fan of the building. I think it's atrocious looking, but it's an exciting venue for college football. And we've been there a number of times for other SEC championship games. We've had some season opening games, you know, Clemson and Vitek just recently, or some exciting games. And those were pretty much, you know, 50-50 splits. And it can still be loud in there. So when you're on the receiving end of, and you, when you're in the minority on the receiving end of the crowd, I'm sure it did get loud, and I don't want to say intimidating necessarily, but I'm sure that that's something that the players, something a little extra that the players had to rebound from.
Oh, absolutely. Hey, what did you think about the start of the game? I know we want to start on the offense, but I thought it was interesting for both quarterbacks, you know, with Murray being the most efficient quarterback in the country and AJ second, you know, both of these quarterbacks threw some, you know, they threw a horrible interception in the first half of that game. It was like, you're the two most sure thing quarterbacks in the nation. And I think both quarterbacks didn't play that great to start the game off.
No, they really didn't. Almost as if they were trying to do too much. They both felt the weight of the situation. You know, I think they both overcame it over the course of the ball game. I think we probably provided a bigger crutch, if you will, in our running game than did Georgia. But I thought they both came out shaky. I thought they both overcame it. And at the end of the game, I thought they both played very, very well.
Well, what did you think in that first half there? I think that I know Eddie Lacy. I guess we must start there. Eddie Lacy probably had his best game running of his career, some would say, and I probably would agree with that. I think he really came out and ran with a toughness that, you know, maybe he's just really getting closer and closer to being fully healthy. But I really think he ran with a toughness that I haven't seen him run with before.
No, he racked up a buck 81, which is phenomenal. Yeldon racked up a buck 53, you know, which is phenomenal. I think what stands out to me in this game, and we've hinted at this, you know, especially going into and coming out of the A&M game, you know, just because you can be balanced doesn't mean that you have to be. And what really stands out to me is the willingness, the aggressive willingness to be out of balance. You know, we ran the ball out of 72 offensive plays. We ran the ball 51 times. 70% of our play calls were runs. And even when we passed, we were out of balance. We completed, you know, out of the 21 pass attempts, I think McCarron completed 13 passes, and 8 of them went to Amari Cooper. That's almost 70%. That's 61%. Of our passing plays that we, you know, that we did have went to one receiver. And so it's almost like we went the other way to go out of our way to be out of balance.
Yeah, that was one of the biggest stats that jumped off the page to me as well when I was checking the stats on the way home, the 51 rushes. You know, we talked about this against LSU. We only had 25 rushes, Texas A&M 31, which drove me crazy. And, you know, last week against Auburn, 47, and this week, 51. It's like this team has, you know, or this coaching staff has realized this is the strength of our team, and we're going to ride this horse.
Yeah, and that's not to mean that we can't pass the ball. I mean, we threw on the play action to Cooper, you know, the go-ahead touchdown was a thing of beauty. And we've had great success passing the ball throughout the season. I am not opposed to us being balanced. I'm not opposed to us being capable of doing both. But when you've got a hot hand, when you've got a horse that will run in a particular game, you need to ride the hell out of it. And that's what we did. And so it's almost, in my mind, lesson learned.
Well, it is. But if you go back to just looking at one of these other games, look at the Missouri game for a second. AJ was 16 of 21 for a buck 71. We had 47 runs out of 68 plays. And we beat Missouri 42-10. So it goes back, you know, Arkansas, he was 14 of 20. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's like, it goes back to that stat I love where, okay, go complete you 14 or 15 out of 20 passes. Well, he attempted 21. I'm okay with that. That's enough. But we were just able to get them off the field, which allowed us to have more running plays, which made a big difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And to finish with, you know, 350 yards, that's just phenomenal. A 6.9 average is just phenomenal. It was a situation that they knew what we were going to do, but could not stop it. And that's just a thing of beauty to see happen.
Oh, it is. I mean, and let's keep in mind for everybody that might not have known, you know, their two inside defensive linemen run 350 and 355 pounds.
Yeah, I thought these boys
carry the weight.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I thought we would struggle to run against them, and especially up the middle. But that's where we had our most success running up the middle. And even some gutsy play calls. When we went for two, and I want to spend a minute talking about this, when we went for two, we did not outthink the situation. we flat ran the ball right up the middle for two in what could have been a catastrophe had that not worked out.
No, and as everybody has written about after this, right? That was just like, okay, just try and stop us. I mean, how many football games have you and I watched and we've seen a team go for two and they do some little tricky play that they've worked on for 2 months in practice? I mean, how many teams just run up the gut like that? I mean, that was just exerting your will like big time.
Absolutely. And Saban coming out of half was interviewed and he said what could have been the most innocuous statement in the world. He said, well, whoever runs better in the second half is probably going to win the game. Who knew that he was capable of such foreshadowing?
Oh, yeah. And I think both teams tried to come out in the second half and really tried to establish the run. And, I know we're going to flip to defense in a second, but I think both teams saw the opportunity to try to slow the game down, so to speak. What do you think about as good of a game as Eddie Lacy did have, and obviously he was the most valuable player, in that first quarter when A.J. had that fumble on that pressure from Jarvis Jones? I'm sure you saw this on the TV that Eddie Lacy was given help to Fluker, and whenever Jones came around Fluker, Eddie just laid into him and chipped him for just a second. And then he turned his back to him, like he gave up and said, okay, well, I've done all I had to do. And Jarvis Jones just kept at it and then was able to cause that fumble on AJ. I thought that was interesting because that was a huge mess up by Lacy, you know, that caused a big turnover. And fortunately they missed a field goal, but it's almost like he came back to redeem himself from that play because yeah. How he played the rest of the game was amped up a little bit.
Yeah, he was lights out from there. And, you know, you think normally on some of these linebackers and Lacy's a big boy, you get a chip on him and, you know, that gets him off balance and McCarron's completing the pass. I think they had some good coverage. You know, I had that marked that, you know, is really a coverage sack. And so what typically works did not work in that situation. And that's just a testament to, you know, the play of Georgia.
It is, and just to highlight that, though, I think we did a really good job of scheming that with Michael Williams or Brian Vogler or Adam Johnson. All three of them was helping out a little bit on the edges with both Cyrus and DJ Fluker just to help a little bit with the rush. I thought that was a good move.
Yeah, I was tracking some of the plays, and I thought early on, we moved Michael. We moved the tight end to the side that the linebacker was on, so that we could provide the extra coverage. And we played a lot of two tight end, and so we were definitely cognizant of their rush. And we did. I think we attempted one pass to the tight end. We basically, and I think for the last couple of weeks, we have left the tight end in to block, and you know that proved to be more and more effective. There were times where you know we would run two tight ends, they would lead block and they would just each individually peel off and knock someone out. And just, you know, that's two more blockers clearing, you know, two more would-be tacklers. And so many runs that we had, you know, were the initial contact was downfield. They showed the graphic and I can't remember what it was, but out of the 350 yards, it was almost 200. It was a number that you just wouldn't believe. It was almost 200 yards before contact.
Wow.
I mean, well, hey, that would have been a good day.
Oh, no, it would have been. It would have been. And we had not, you know, we put up 362 yards against a Missouri team, which has a far different defense. And so, hell, we put up 300 yards on Western Carolina. So to put up 350 on Georgia, that's a huge stat that I had to check that a couple times on the way home because I was like, that can't possibly be correct.
Yeah, it's almost unbelievable. And I want to call out, and I'm sure there's a couple things you want to call out too. I want to call out a 7-play drive that I think was just decisive, you know, in the game. And it was late in the third, and then the last play of the drive was the first play of the fourth quarter. But it was a 78-yard drive, 7 plays, all runs. Lacy ran the ball 5 times, and then Yeldon got 2 carries. In fact, Lacy had 4 runs, Yeldon had 2, and then Lacy came in to score the touchdown. And I think out of Lacy's runs, you know, one was for a touchdown, So that's four left. Three of them were for first downs. One was for 30 plus yards. And then he got stuff for a 2 yard gain. But I just felt like he took over that drive, and watching that, it just was reminiscent. It wasn't an exact match, but it was reminiscent of Mark Ingram taking over the South Carolina game, where he says, guys, just give me the ball and I'm going to run and we're going to drive down here and we're going to score a critical touchdown. You know, that wasn't the game winner necessarily, but we were still accumulating points. It was a critical score in the ball game.
It was a critical score. And just to highlight something you said there, because it was reminiscent of the Mark Ingram series there, is Eddie Lacy rushes for 32 yards, then 15 up the middle, then 14 up the middle. Well, then on the very next play, it's first and 10 at the 13. And just to criticize the coaches for a second, Eddie Lacy gets the ball a fourth time in a row, and he gets tackled in the backfield by Jarvis Jones and loses 2 yards. And so now it's second and 12 at the 15. And I remember saying in the game, of course he's tired. He comes out right after that play, and I'm like, that was a bad move by the coaches. And you and I call it like I see it. And you've got a horse that's run 32 yards, 15 yards, and 14 yards. He should not have been in on that first and 10. That could have cost them, because this is where they were trying to answer. And so then it's second and 12. TJ Yeldon, thank goodness, rushes for 13 yards, and now it's first and goal at the 2. But my point is, I know I'm being nitpicky, but very excited with the win. But that was a situation where they should have brought the horse out one play earlier.
Well, I agree. That is nitpicky. And if you want to really fine-tune and be technical on that, I think Lacy should have tapped out. I think in that, if he was that winded, he's going to know that better than the coaches.
That's fair. Hey, what did you think about the goal line play in the first half by Lacy, where he tries to reach the ball out and it doesn't cross the plane, and the ball pops out, and thank goodness AJ falls on it. But, you know, that kind of foreshadowed that next play, because now we lost 5 yards on the play.
Well, it really did. I will tell you this, and I've not read this anywhere. I've not seen this anywhere. The commentators have not commentated on this anywhere. I was at home alone watching that game, and so I had the benefit of like DVR and slow-mo replays, and I watched that play a dozen times in addition to the replays that they had. And one thing that the commentators did not reference was when, and there was a beautiful angle that showed this, when Lacy made his lunge. I don't know what the announcers are watching, but if you watch the back of the defender, the ball emerges from behind his back. Lacy's still holding it. And if you draw a line from where that ball emerges down to the goal line, I think it crossed. I think
really?
He actually scored a touchdown there. Really think he scored that touchdown.
Okay. Yeah, I went back and watched the replay and tried to just watch the slow-mo a couple times, and it just seemed – I wasn't able to spot the ball. It just seemed hard with the defenders there to be able to make heads or tails of it, but it looked to you like it crossed?
Yes, absolutely. And I would implore anyone to go back and look at it again. And there's an angle that they show – where it looks like this is not a good angle, because all I see is the back of the defender. That's all I can see. And that runs and runs and runs. And just before it clips to, you know, they go to another angle. If you just watch the ball emerge from the back of the defender and then you just look down, it looked like it had crossed the line.
Okay. Well, I will definitely have to go back and check that out. You know, that sets up that next play, which we highlighted at the beginning of the podcast. Who the hell was AJ throwing the ball to, the pylon or the Georgia defensive back?
I think, you know, and this is one where I think Danielson got it right. You know, we were trying to throw the back shoulder. I don't know if maybe the receiver didn't pick up on that. And when that's a play that when it works, it looks great. And when it doesn't work, it looks like, where are you throwing the ball? I think we were trying to back shoulder that one, and I don't know if the receiver didn't get the memo, or certainly the defender did. And to your point, that was crushing, because, you know, we're going to score, and then we turn the ball over.
Yeah, and you know how Saban is, right? I mean, every coach would love to be this way, but we would have at least gotten three there. You know, just a team like Georgia, just kind of pick up points where you can. Hey, one other thing I wanted to touch on the offensive side of the ball is AJ really should have had a second pick. He really should have had another pick on that deep ball to Amari Cooper. Amari Cooper just made a fabulous play on the ball. But when you go back and watch the replay, you know, they were playing zone and they had released Amari, the corner had, and Amari had them, had the safety, had the angle, had him beat. AJ lays it up like he did later in the game. You know, we have another touchdown there to Amari Cooper.
Yeah, I agree. If he put a little more under the ball, then Amari certainly could have run under it. That was a big-time play by Amari. And you watch his performance in a game like Saturday, and you watch his performance on a play like that, and you could not convince people that he's a true freshman. That's just a phenomenal heads-up, my-ball mentality that you typically don't have coming just so fresh right out of high school.
Oh, no. That's a play that you're lucky if a senior does.
Right.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. Hey, we also would be remiss. It probably should have been our headline to talk about this offensive line. You got the benefit of listening to Danielson at home, but, you know, Barrett Jones getting nicked up in the first half and gutting it out there. And just this whole offensive line, you know, I think Steen and Fluker had the work of having to play at the point of attack on most of those runs in the second half. There wasn't a lot of pulling. There wasn't a lot of traps. It was just straight ahead, bull you, and I'm just going to knock your butt off the football.
It was. And so we've talked about the rushing and the success of the running backs and us kind of relying on that. And so it's sort of baked into that, and it's right to call it out, you know, so intentionally, is the performance of the offensive line. You mentioned a couple of weeks ago that, you know, hats off. Whatever game it was, that was the best performance of the season for Anthony Steen. I think it might be fair to say that this is the best performance by each of the individual linemen all season.
That's fair. I thought you were going to go Steen because I think Steen definitely improved on that. But I think how they were able to handle those two inside defensive tackles at the point of attack and the fact that we weren't cutesy about it, you know, it goes back to what you said earlier when you were talking about, you know, what's working, just stick with it. Well, John Jenkins is a hoss.
Sure.
And John Jenkins still filled up the stat sheet, but we just literally whipped those guys inside. And I'm sure everybody on the forums and the boards, you know, saw the reference by the Sports Illustrated article that John Jenkins went up to DJ Fluker after the game and said, you know, what blocking technique were you using on me? Because I have not been blocked like that my whole career. Did you see that?
I have not seen that. I'm going to have
yes.
to.
Yes, he literally asked Fluker after the game. He said, I have not had that blocking scheme done on me ever. What exactly were you doing to me?
That is phenomenal. That is, you know, the way you and I go, we can spend 20 minutes just on that because, you know, that gets into recruiting, that gets into technique, that gets into, you know, there's so many, you know, sort of angles off of that, but just on its face, that is phenomenal. And, you know, we were talking about that drive where Lacey kind of took over and, you know, was reminiscent of Ingram's, you know, drive against South Carolina. You know, one thing in the telecast that I think it was the third run that Lacey broke off that 14 yarder, you know, Gary Danielson's paid, you know, I don't know what he's paid $1 million a year to, you know, on national television to commentate these games and, you know, add his expert opinion. And on that play, you know, Vern called it, there was dead air and Danielson just said, beautiful. And I was like, you know what? That's right. That's exactly what that is. Hey, there were a couple other things on offense, and you know, these are kind of, you know, maybe a little nitpicky, maybe a little nuanced. You know, we had the pass interference call on the defender, would have given us a critical first down. They waved it off and said that the ball had been tipped. I have the benefit of having watched some of the replay. Maybe you've taken a look at that. What's your gut on that?
I did watch it, but I only watched it 3 or 4 times, and for the life of me, it looks to me like he barely touched the ball on the backside where the white stripe is, but he just kind of grazed it. And what just doesn't make sense is the spin of the ball did not change. And I've heard after this game that the Georgia coaches were lighting up the, you know, the sideline judge trying to get the call. And I went back and looked at it two or three times, and it looks like if he touched it, he barely touched it around the back of the football, and he had to just touch it with, you know, one pinky. I mean, if he touched it, it was barely.
I am convinced that the ball was not touched. And, you know, and that's a play that I watched, you know, again, kind of home alone, watching it with the DVR and slow-mo-ing their slow-mo. I'm convinced that it was not touched. You know, the physics of the situation is if you touch it, you're going to impart force on the object that you're touching. And so a spinning football, if you touch it, it's going to wobble. It's going to alter the trajectory. And, you know, and I use the analogy of, you know, I'm a big fan of the show Mythbusters. And every time they record something in with, like, you know, slow motion, you know, high speed cameras, they always have like a grid in the background that serves as a frame of reference. It's a point of context. And so when that ball was spinning and it was going through sort of the wave of the arms, it was actually the laces were, you know, forward to the camera. And so it wasn't just a brown sort of blob of the ball where maybe I can't tell. There were the laces there, and the laces maintained a perfect straight line, even as the ball, you know, was spinning its normal, you know, pass. I am convinced that ball was not touched. It would have, if it had been touched, there would have been force imparted on the ball, and that would have been very easy to see with even just within the laces that were so visible on the camera, on the screen. I'm convinced that ball was not touched. I think that was a bad reversal.
Well, that was a big call because obviously the block field goal happens next, and you and I talked about, you know, I guess we can get in that when we talk about special teams. I won't go any further than that right now, but that was a huge call because that would have been a first and 10, you know, inside the 30-yard line for Georgia, and maybe we definitely get points out of that. Anything else that jumped out at you on the offensive side of the ball?
I thought it was gutsy that we did a fake punt, and then it was very, very aggravating that we get it, but there's a delay of game. I thought that was very aggravating.
I was going to jump on this on special teams, but we can just spend a second about this. This is not the first time that Coach Saban has lit up Vinny for letting the clock run out.
Right.
It was either Western Kentucky or Florida Atlantic that Vinny got a nice chewing out late in the game for doing the exact same thing. Yeah. And so that was one of the few – that was one of two penalties in the ball game. That was not his first time to have that problem.
And then just one more thing that I want to call out, and I found this humorous. You know, McCarron got hit, and they called it a helmet-to-helmet, and they threw the flag. Later in the game, Dial hit Murray, and they did not call it. Look, we probably should, if you're going to call it in our favor, you probably should have called it against Dial. But when they got the personal foul, you know, so they're marching off the 15 yards, that was a big penalty. They showed, you know, Mark Richt, and clearly you could tell that he was upset. And clear as day, Mark Richt is a better man than me. Clear as day, you could read his lips, and he said, "That's bull crap."
About the personal foul call?
Yeah, about the personal foul call. He did not think that it should have been called. And so his venting of emotion was, "That's bull crap."
Well, that was one thing I wanted to talk about before we flip the sides of the ball is after Georgia blocks that field goal and goes up 21-10 and the place is electric and the place is going wild. You know, they have that personal foul. When we're at the 23, it moves us to the 38. Three plays later, they have a pass interference. We get the ball on the 10-yard line. So I wanted to point this out because during the whole game, Georgia fans were getting really tired of it seemed like plays were going our way. And when I went back and looked at the stats after the game, they had 7 penalties on the night, mm-hmm. and we only had 2.
Yep.
But if you look at it for the season, we had 50 penalties on the year, and they had 90. So they obviously are averaging 7 or 8 penalties a game as their norm. So it's not like they're a disciplined football team.
Right.
But on that particular drive, you're up by 11. The crowd's in it. Now's the time. I mean, to your point earlier, that could have been your make or break. you get a three and out there and you might be about to put the game away. Yes. And what do? You give the number two team in the country two penalties for 30 yards of field position. That was a huge screw up by Georgia.
Sure. And that's deflating for, you know, their defense. And, you know, maybe they had a little bit of a lapse and, you know, that's what, you know, that's what helped us, you know, score. You know, I don't know, but that's critical in a situation like that. You go up by 11, we've got them. And then you have the mental breakdown.
That's well, tough. And because of that, David, though, we were able to answer on a four play drive that took 2 minutes.
Right.
So that's why when I turned to my wife and I said, okay, it's like the last 2 minutes just didn't happen. It was a quick way to get the bad taste out of your mouth.
Sure.
Okay. They scored 2 minutes later. We scored back. Okay. We're back to 4-point game.
Yes. We're back to where we were. So we can do this now. Yeah. That was critical that we were able to score so quickly. And so, you know, the mistakes that they made, you know, they really shot themselves in the foot there.
Hey, what about defense? What jumped out at you on our defensive side of the ball?
I don't know, really. You know, I think what jumped out to me was the play of Geno Smith. What really jumped out to me, and we've been building on this the last couple of games, unfortunately, you know, ever since the A&M kind of debacle, coach coming out and saying, you know, gosh, maybe I should have been playing Geno Smith, you know, more during the season. And he has played almost every snap of every game since then. And Georgia went after him. They purposely targeted him a couple of times. And he came up with big play after big play after big play, batting a ball, not letting a receiver catch the ball, you know, making the tackle. He just was Johnny on the spot so many times. And then in a similar note, and he probably made more of the headline type plays, but HaHa, who we've been after a little bit for being out of position and struggling, he has gotten a lot more run the last few weeks, and it seemed to really pay dividends on Saturday. He, you know, obviously had the interception, big play, but he had a critical bat the ball away where he made a play on the ball instead of the play on the receiver. You know, you can get burned doing that flag or if they catch the ball. But he made the right decision, the right play, batted the ball away. Both of them really stepped up. Both of them did things that probably a month ago they could not do.
That's fair. And I think HaHa, I'd have to go back and check the stats, but I think he might have broke up too.
He may have.
Oh, okay. He only got credit for one on the stat sheet, but I think he might have done a second one. Well, you know, just to highlight that for a second, because I do agree with Geno's play, and we didn't see John Fulton because of that. I did notice that we stayed a lot in the safety nickel and dime formation pretty much most of the game. But I think D. Milner had one of his worst games of the year. I mean, if I got to talk about Geno, I'm sorry, I just said D. Milner. Blue, I think he had his worst game of the season.
Oh yeah,
he looked lost, man.
Clearly, he was turned around. I was going to fight you on Milner, but Blue, I'm gonna absolutely agree with you.
He's a gutsy player, but he just seemed out of position.
He seemed to be making the mental mistakes. Now he is a JUCO. This is his first year in the system, and he seemed to be making, you know, quote unquote freshman type mistakes. And so, you know, maybe there's some parallel with him being a first year in the system kind of guy, but he seemed to just turn the wrong way.
Yep.
And just leave a wide open receiver two or three times easily.
Oh yeah. As we're talking about defense, you know, when we had that first turnover at the beginning of the ball game and Georgia had a chance to, you know, put some points on the board there, you know, Aaron Murray stepped back to pass on a 3rd and 9. And who made the sack but Xavier Dixon?
Yes.
And on the very next series, who made another sack but Xavier Dixon?
Yeah, he had two games.
I just want to say he had a really good ball game. You know, Hubbard made some plays too, but Dixon really stepped up in this ball game.
He really did. I was very, very pleased with his performance. You know, C.J. Mosley was – you know, instrumental there at the end of the game and tip the ball. But, you know, he had been visible throughout the day. I had a really good day. You know, hats off to Jesse Williams, clog in the middle. He got injured. Brandon Ivory came in, who was injured and had really not played a lot. I think you had the call right that Damian Square would step into the middle. He definitely, I think, was subbing more inside than Ivory, but Ivory came in late, injured, and then Jesse Williams came back. And so I give credit. You know, Jesse Williams came in injured, was more visible than Brandon, but, you know, Brandon came in and played when it looked like maybe he wasn't going to play. And then Jesse came back and, you know, even came out at fullback as well as nose guard. So, you know, hats off to him for his gutty performance.
Oh, yeah. When I saw him come out for fullback, I knew he must be okay. But I went back and looked at the replay on that play because I was curious if there had been an illegal chip block. And there was not. He was engaged with the center and someone else took left guard and just beat him. And the left guard was falling to the ground. And it wasn't your typical roll up on your knee. Mm-hmm. Jesse Williams' cleat got stuck in the replay. And he couldn't pull it out, but it looked to me like he barely hyperextended it. And so when you go back and look at the replay, it comes in a little bit, but it could have been a lot worse.
Sure.
I think that's why he was able to come back.
Yeah, that's the kind of injury when you get that little twinge, it scares you. You know, as a player,
it does. It
scares the hell out of you.
Oh, yeah.
Because you just don't know. And so, you know, after a few minutes and, you know, let's ice it down, let's put a brace on it, you know, let's see what you can – you know, do over here on the sidelines. And you know, and sometimes within a matter of, you know, 10, 15, 20 minutes, you kind of get back to feeling right. But, you know, you have that little fear, you have that little scare. And so I think that he's probably going to be okay. We wouldn't have put him back out there. Sure.
And being, you know, and this is the benefit of being at the game, as you and I know, with injuries and the camera angles and what they can do. I mean, he came off like he had broken his leg.
Yes.
Or he had broken an ankle. And he was literally laying on a cart for a good little while. And I said, I can't believe they're not even taking him straight to the locker room the way they just carried him off the field. Mm-hmm. And then he just sat there and sat there and sat there. And then finally they got a knee brace and put it on him. And he slowly got up and started working around with it. And then when he did a couple, you know, squatting down with it, I was like, okay, wait a minute, we might be okay here. But man, to see him come off the field and how long it took, I thought he was gone for the year.
Sure. It had the feel of that.
Oh, yeah. And talking about Brandon Ivory for a second, I was surprised that he didn't come in right away because Georgia's touchdown in the third quarter to put them up 14-10, I think it had more to do with no Jesse Williams in the game.
Yes.
And what he was doing in the middle, because as soon as he came out, to their credit, no offense to Damian Square, they started doubling Damian, and Todd Gurley was just running right up the middle.
Sure.
Now, there was a nice holding call on C.J. Mosley at the goal line that didn't get called, where literally the guard pulled C.J. Mosley down. And on the Georgia Coaches Show, I got the benefit of the camera angle from behind the goal post to see the hold very well, but it was not called. But when Ivory did come in later in that game, he blew up two plays in a row.
Yeah.
And so that was very good to see. Hey, what did you think about? I know we're spending the time on defense for a second, but man, you and I talked about that Gurley kid earlier in the year. He reminds me of a small Trent Richardson. I just got to give props where I need to. That kid's a beast.
Yeah, he is. He is a very, very good player. He is someone that Georgia fans should really be ecstatic over. He's going to really be a good one for the
Bulldogs. That was a tough matchup for our defense, I guess, is where I was trying to go with that. I mean, that was a really tough matchup for our defense.
He's incredibly talented, you know, and I'll say hats off to the Georgia recruiting. You know, they pulled Isaiah Crowell last year in the recruiting game, and of course he had, you know, interpersonal issues, and then this year they bring in Gurley and Marshall. That's some stout recruiting, even just at the running back position.
Oh, it is. Hey, anything else jumped out at you on defense? It seemed to me that besides picking on or having a couple success plays with Ballou, it seemed like they also had a little success over the middle against the safeties once again.
Yeah, I hesitate, to call it out necessarily, but their first touchdown, you know, Nick Perry was beat pretty bad. you know, Leicester, I think we were trying to disguise a little bit. Leicester ran up.
Yeah, was that Leicester or Perry? Did Leicester come up for a run blitz and Perry didn't rotate over? Was that what happened?
That's what I think happened. I think we were disguising our coverages and we ran Leicester up. I watched, and again, this is something I've had the benefit of watching a couple times. I thought, well, why is he streaking up? I thought, well, he got sucked in by the play action. And so he got beat by the play action. That's why it looked so bad on the back end. But when I watched it a couple more times, he was rushing up before the ball snapped. And so what we were doing is we were disguising, and then right before the snap of the ball, we were putting another man in the box. So I think that was purely Perry being out of position on the back end.
Okay.
I mean, I hate to kind of
be
down on the guy, but that's because we've talked about him in the past. But when I don't have the benefit of knowing the defense and what the call was and all of that. But my first reaction was, oh, Leicester bit on the play action. But no, he did not. He was rushing down to kind of get into the box before the ball was snapped. And then so, you know, to me, when you see how then the play breaks down, gosh, it looks like the safety's out of position. And it just so happened that it was Perry in that play.
Well, there is one other play on defense that I think is, well, there's a couple, but another one that jumps out at me was the third and one that Georgia had at their 17-yard line. And they had been able to hold us, you know, AJ had scrambled. They had held us to punt the ball. They get the ball with 7 minutes left in the game. And a Georgia fan turns to me and says, if he can do something here, Murray will be a Georgia legend. And they had first and 10, they do nothing. Second and 10, Gurley rushes up the middle for 9 yards,
mm-hmm.
setting up a third and one. And for us to stop them, and who was on the tackle but Jesse Williams and Brandon Ivory?
Yep.
That might have been one of the plays of the game for the defense.
Sure.
What did you think about – I was surprised that when we were not able to ice the game, because they had 11 guys in the box, and we give the ball back to them, and they have no timeouts. Were you surprised that we stopped pressuring the quarterback, which had worked so well, and literally just rushed three before it got really intense there on that drive? I think that was a bad move early on that drive.
Yeah, the old cliche about a prevent defense, and that's what we moved to. You know, we came within just a hair of getting an interception that would have ended it. But, you know, it was and I talked to our buddy Greg after the game. And I like the analogy that he had. You know, they had the ball at the 15 and they had
a minute left. Yeah,
they had just a minute left, but no timeouts. And to me, that was critical. I was like, well, I feel pretty good about this. And Greg used the analogy of, it's like when you watch poker on television, and not that I watch a lot of that, but I've seen just enough to get, you know, his reference. They, you know, they show the hand that the player has, and they show like a little percent, you know, based on the cards that are revealed, his, you know, this player's percent chance of winning this hand is this. And so a card will come out and his percent chance adjusts based on, you know, this new information. And so it was like with each play, as they started to move the ball down the field, tick, 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 the percent chance of them, you know, pulling it out. I don't know what it got up to at the end, but damn, it got pretty high.
Right.
I'll say this. That clock operator was hitting the stop button on that clock pretty aggressively.
Oh, you think so?
Oh, boy. There were some plays that just didn't hardly take any time. And I was just amazed that, you know, this is the longest minute in the history of a football game that I've ever, you know, witnessed. And, you know, I'm not necessarily, you know, maybe I'm being facetious more than anything else, but gosh, it seemed like some of those plays, you know, 1001, 1002, you know, just right. Seemed to really kind of drag and drag and drag.
Well, I got frustrated that early on that drive, when we had some success pressuring the quarterback, we drop eight and we play zone. And you and I both know playing zone is not our strength. Our guys don't seem, you know, because of what we talked about in the past, dropping in zone there's holes in our zone. And so I wish we would have just stayed in our regular base defense.
I understand what you're saying. I think the balance or the counterpoint is that the zone is safer. And are there holes in the zone? Yes. But all the holes in the zone are in front of us. Whereas if we go man to man and, you know, Deion Blue gets turned around again or something like that, it's done. It's over. And so I think that's the counterpoint.
Okay. But here's the thing, right? When there's no time on the clock, what are teams going to do? They're going to go to the sidelines. But what has been our weakness on this defense? The middle of the field. So what really frustrated me as I'm sitting there watching that in person is first and 10 at the 40, first and 10 at the 28. We made a pass across the, they made a pass across the middle that Milner almost picked. Then what do they do the next time? They go across the middle for 15, the very next play, across the middle for 23, the very next play, across the middle for 26. And that's where Vinny forgot how to tackle and decided to ride him like a pony to the 8-yard line. Mm-hmm. And so my point is they have no time on the clock, but because the clock stops on first downs in college football, they ran four plays in a row in the middle of our defense and drove from the 28 of Georgia to the 8 of us.
Yes.
And that just shouldn't happen.
No, it shouldn't, but it did. What do you make of they're not clocking the ball and going in and running the play?
You know, I listened to Mark Richt after the post game press conference, and he said they knew the play, they had the play they liked, and they wanted to get a third play instead of taking up the time with the spike in the ball. Man, I think they should have spiked the ball, just like I think Coach Saban should have called a damn timeout on fourth and goal at the 2 with Texas
A&M.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm sorry. This is your season. You get everybody making sure everybody knows what they're doing, because on that final play that CJ made a hell of a play, and CJ, I'm sorry we haven't said it to start with because you saved the game potentially. The wide receiver on the outside supposedly was supposed to run to the back of the end zone on a fade.
Yep.
Where guess what? He didn't do what he was supposed to. He ran the same bad pattern that Amari Cooper did earlier in the game. And so had the ball not been tipped, it would have still been an incomplete pass. And so I think that you should have spiked it and you get everybody where they're supposed to be.
I completely agree. And so, you know, and I read somewhere where, you know, you can make a case either way. If the ball falls incomplete, they get another play anyways. And so the thought is if they spike it, they get two plays. And so, you know, it can happen either way. What stood out to me is on the play leading up, it was the 18-yard play to the tight end. And so, you know, everyone's running up the field, and they show just a perfect angle of Aaron Murray running up to getting those guys up, and he's looking over at the bench. And I wish, you know, we're on podcast, you know, I wish it was almost a video. He was running up, and he was like throwing his arms down, like mimicking throwing the ball into the ground, you know, like everyone sees quarterbacks.
Right. Right.
And so he's doing that, like, we're going to clock it, right? We're going to clock it. And you can tell he's looking over at the coaches, we're going to clock it. And he just stops. And you can see him do just an ever so slight head tilt, like, really?
We're just going to run the play?
Okay. And to me, that's just, and this is where you can get into just the deep psychology of, you know, he knows I've got to run this play and tick, tick, tick. And all of the things that the quarterback's thinking about, I've got to run this play. What's the next play? And I've got to get guys lined up for the next
play. Two plays in case this play doesn't work. And yeah.
All of those things that the quarterback is thinking about. And you think, man, why don't we clock it? It's a first down. We're not going to get to fourth down anyways. We can burn the down and we can call two plays in the huddle so that everybody knows what we're going to do. And we know that they know what we're going to do because we've taken this extra time to communicate it.
Yes.
I just think that is as egregious as Saban not calling a timeout at half.
At half.
Yeah. At half, you know, we get the ball on the 5 and we're running the ball, and clearly you run
the ball. You mean when AJ scrambled?
Yeah.
Yes.
And so clearly you run the ball, you know, two or three times, we're going to score a touchdown there, except for you can't run it two or three times when there's 5 seconds left. And so had we called a timeout and we went to half with two of them in our pocket, worthless. And so had we called the timeout there, we could have at least gotten one good opportunity to run the ball.
Or throw in the end zone real quick.
Or throw in the end zone. But we're having such success running, though. We get a shot at the end zone, I guess is what I'm saying. And so yes. When you get to, oh, man, we could probably line up and run this in, but we've got to kick the field goal here because we can't leave those 3 points on the table.
Well, I don't know if it has more to do with just the tight ball game and getting points where you can, but sometimes I think Coach Saban thinks, and I mean, obviously he doesn't think this, he's a smart coach, but sometimes you think he thinks he can take those first half timeouts and carry them over to the second half.
I think sometimes he just doesn't want to use them. It's almost like he views it as a sign of weakness that we
I have to call timeout.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to reveal that I'm not prepared in this situation, that my team is not prepared. And as a player, you weren't prepared to do what we needed to do because you had to use a timeout.
Well, I wish you would have showed that weakness against Texas A&M. Hey, anything else on the defensive side of the ball?
No, I think we covered defense pretty well. Why don't you take us to special teams?
You know, let's just go to that fake punt real quick. I mean, first of all, I was shocked that both of these coaches pulled it out. They both pulled it out about the 30-something yard line, respectively. But, you know, we talked about it a little bit earlier, but, you know, Saban was just livid on the sideline. That was just a great call at a great time, and that would have made a big difference in the ball game.
Oh, yeah, it was very frustrating. We should have gotten that. And then their play call for their fake field goal was masterful. The way that they lined up, they had a receiver covered, and so he was an ineligible receiver. But the way that where he was lined up, he was basically a slot receiver that was on the line, but he's covered up. So he can't go out for a pass. He's ineligible. But when you just look at the formation, the naked eye tells you, I need to cover this guy. And on the other end of the formation, there's, you know, a tight end is, you know, maybe a yard off the line of scrimmage, a yard off the sort of the grouping, and he's back. And so he's the eligible receiver. But he just looks like he's there to, like, cover the corner. It was masterful formation. And so he is why. And so our coverage shifts to cover the ineligible. And then so everyone sees, oh, there's a nice cushy spot right there across the first down line. This is the tight end.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, the tight end runs. And if you have a chance, I don't know if you have, if you have a chance to go back and look at that one, hats off to that play design. That is winning a play at the chalkboard. That's
what and Mark Richt talked about in his post game that they had been working on that play for 6 weeks in practice. He said it wasn't meant for Alabama. It was just meant for a certain situation.
It was meant for,
Hey, what about the Cade Foster field goal attempt, you know, that was blocked? You and I talked weeks ago about his inconsistency is going to dictate play calling, which might have dictated that 4th-and-1 fake punt that we just talked about instead of trying a longer field goal. But in that situation, shouldn't you have punted the ball? I mean, just given all the dynamics of everything we've talked about with Cade Foster right now in that moment in the game and the way Georgia's offense was playing, shouldn't you have punted the ball and pinned him in deep?
Man, it's easy to look back and say that now.
But I'm talking about the merits of the attempted field goal. I mean, it has more to do with that's just not his field goal. It's only 49 yards on the stat sheet here, but I just didn't love the call.
Did he hit one or two 50-yard plus field goals in Dallas?
Two.
Okay. And so I think there's some thought that, you know, he can hit these in a dome. And so let's get points. We need points. And I think that was the mentality. You know, we're aggressively going after points. And hindsight being, you know, what it is, I mean, if we had just kicked it and he just missed it, I don't know that we would feel so strongly about, gosh, I wish he had punted. But because it went so, it went as horribly wrong as it could go. They scored a touchdown on our field goal attempt.
Right.
It doesn't get any worse than that. It's impossible. And so because of that, it's easy to then come back and say, maybe it would have been better if we had punted. I don't know. I didn't think it was that bad of a call at the time. I just knew that he might not make it. Was really my concern is that, we've not seen him kick a long one in a while, and that he just may not make it.
Okay. What do you think about the special teams? Anything else jumped out at you? I thought both teams didn't really, they seemed, Georgia definitely seemed content to start their possessions at the 25-yard line, which really surprised me because, Malcolm Mitchell is a very dynamic player with the ball in his hands. And I was surprised a couple times that he just let it go over his head. He could have caught it about 5 yards deep in the end zone, and he didn't even make a play for it 2 or 3 times.
I think that's the right answer. I wish that we had been so disciplined. You look at the stat sheet, and Cyrus Jones had, and this is a pet peeve, and this is something that we've talked about, but Cyrus Jones had 89 yards in kickoff returns. When the hell did he do that? By running the ball out to the 20 a number of times.
We could have had 100 yards of field position.
Right.
We could have started the 25 four times.
Right. And so what's so frustrating to me, and I wish they would change the stat record this way, you only gain yards beyond what will give you for free. And so instead of running out to the 20 a couple times, and every time you run to the 20, you get 20 yards, that should be -5 on your stat sheet. He should have negative return yards instead of 89 return yards.
Oh yeah, because he should have a -11, right? For the sum of the returns.
And you know what? Even if maybe it's a little grandiose to request all of football to change how they record stats. Do you know what I would do if I were the coach though? I would post the negative yards.
Oh, yeah, just to send a message.
I don't care what the NCAA wants to do it or how the NFL wants to do it or how you did it in high school. On this team, here's how we grant yards. And you have negative return yards, and you want to be the return guy? No,
that's a good point. Anything else jumped out at you on special teams?
No, I was very disappointed with special teams. I mean, they blocked a field goal, returned it for a touchdown. It does not get worse than that. They made a fake punt. We botched a fake punt. The whole Cyrus Jones thing, trying to return kicks out of the end zone, let them go and we get more yards.
Good thing I will say, though, is they didn't have a big play from their punt return or their kickoff return. That keeps them from getting a failing grade. No, Georgia did not make a big play either one of those ways.
No, that's fair. They could have returned a kickoff or even a punt. And so, our coverage units the kickoff units were strong, but we did a good job of kicking it into the end zone.
And that's where I need to give Cade Foster some props.
Yeah. And so maybe I'm being a little harsh, he deserves some props for that. And then Mandale had 5 punts and, he averaged over 41 yards. And so, that's strong and that's what you need to have happen in that situation. Some of his numbers more recently have been better, but if you're going to punt it that many times, you need to average over 40. And so he was at almost 42. And so I think they're very, very limited return yards that they got. And so the coverage units perform there. So there's more positive there than I wanted to admit, because some of the flaws on special teams were pretty glaring.
Oh, they were. Hey, kick us off with mini game balls. Who gets yours on offense?
I am torn on offense. I want to give it to Warmack. There were a couple of plays that he just looked like a bulldozer. I was the football nerd accountant guy because like I said, my wife was out of town, and so I was just watching the game by myself. I literally wrote down every play in the game, and just kept track of what was happening down a distance. I've got 9 pages of game notes. I could go a year from now and relive this game. And there were times that I wrote down that Warmack was just a bulldozer. And so I want to give, him a mini game ball. I want to give one to Fluker as well. There were a couple times that that he really got fired up. There was one time he just seemed to jump up and down out of frustration that, you know, not him, because he was pancaking somebody, but that maybe someone else missed a block. And he just seemed to have a lot of passion, and I think he was motivating across the offensive line. I could go through and name each of them and a play that they did that really stood out to me. I'm going to stop there at DJ and Warmack, and they are representative of the entire offensive line.
Well, I definitely could have given mine to the offensive line, because, you know, I agree with you. They had a hell of a ball game. But I think in the same vein, I think I also have to give a shout out to the tight ends or to the H-backs.
Yes.
Because I think that Harrison Jones and Brian Vogler and Kelly Johnson have gotten far better on their blocking as the season has progressed. And if you would have told me that with just one beefy guy and Michael Williams, that we would have that. Yep. I mean, last year with our three tight ends, right? If you had told me that we were going to lose two tight ends, and we were going to have just one veteran returning tight end, and Saban was going to find a way to get these other role players to be able to do what they did against Georgia to contribute to our 350 yards. Are you freaking kidding me?
Sure.
Kelly Johnson? Harrison Jones? Really?
Well, and Jostin Fowler not being the H-back.
Yes.
I agree with that, and I give hats off for that pick. And that's in the true spirit of the mini game ball. You know, none of us picked the headline offensive guys. I want his headline is you know, I kind of like to go with this and picking the offensive line. But I think you went more nuanced, which is an extension of the offensive line, which is the H-backs. No one knows their name, you know, and the tight ends. And again, outside of Michael Williams, none of them really have any beef. But Vogler and Harrison and Kelly Johnson all stepped up and performed well. So that's a good pick. Who you got on defense?
Man, on defense, you know, I want to give it to Geno Smith just because Geno Smith had such a good game. But I've got to break the rules and just give it to two other – well, man, I could give it to a bunch of guys, sure. Honestly. Man, it's hard. What the hell, man? It's our last big game of the year before the championship game. I'm giving it to Geno Smith for the reasons you mentioned. I'm giving it to CJ Mosley because he won the game on that play. I'm giving it to Damian Square for being unselfish and getting over the center and getting his butt double teamed when this is not his role and he just slid right down and said, okay, here I go. I'm giving it to Jesse Williams for coming back in this ball game and showing such heart. And I'm doing the same to Ed Stinson because Ed Stinson got hurt. And yep. Guess who also came back in the game? Yep,
he came back in and played.
I mean, I didn't even mention Xavier Dixon. I mean – there are several people on this defense that stepped up.
That's a lot of balls, man.
It's a lot of balls, but it goes back to what Mark May said. This team does not have stars. They got a bunch of guys that play damn well together.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with that. I'm going to go and sort of in the vein of if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I'm going to go with Geno Smith. And this is a third week in a row that I've, you know, kind of tipped my hat in that way. I think that he has his performance and his role and his contribution has increased each of those weeks. And to the extent that Georgia picked on him, Georgia targeted him as this is the guy that we can beat. And he proved over the course of the game, they went away from him and then they came back later in the game and said, no, this is still the guy that we can beat. And they could not beat him. That's a phenomenal performance by a freshman. You know, a lot of fans necessarily don't know, you know, who his name is. And you rattled off a lot of guys that kind of fit in that category as well. But I'm going Geno Smith with my mini game ball.
Oh, that's awesome. Hey, anything else on this game?
You know what? We got an email that came in and Rob, you know, gave us his vote for a mini game ball. So I'll give him a nod and call out his players. He went Warmack for all the reasons we've talked about. And he went Jesse Williams for all the reasons that you talked about. So, you know, shout out for Rob. Thanks for the email and reaching out. In terms of other things in this game, you know, this was one for the ages. I really believe that.
History of Alabama football right here.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the 23rd SEC title. You know, here's a stat that I thought was pretty phenomenal. we've had some downtimes pre-Saban, and we had a long dry spell. And so considering the dry spell that we've had, this is the 20th year that they've played an SEC championship game. We were the first one and won it, went on to win a national title. We're in this, the 20th one, won it, maybe to go on, certainly to play for and maybe win a national title. But we have played in 8 of these bad boys. That's almost half in the 20-year history. And we've had some very, very dry years in that spell. That's pretty impressive for the program overall, right?
Oh, sure. No, absolutely. Hey, what do you think about this big game that we've got January 7th? What's just your first stab? I know we're going to have some additional shows and break it down further, but what's your first stab at this? I mean, how excited are you that we get to see the University of Alabama play Notre Dame?
You know what? And it's so layered, and I think it's phenomenal. You know, we open the season, you know, the University of Alabama and the history and the tradition that we have. And we open the season with, you know, University of Michigan, another storied historical program. And what a beautiful way to kind of start the season in Dallas. And then have the opportunity that no one would have predicted, that we have the opportunity to finish the season with one of the also, you know, pillar programs in the history of college football, Notre Dame. What a fantastic way to book in this season. And so I think that, you know, from that dynamic, that it's a all-time classic, you know, opportunity to match up. I'll say this. Everyone talks about Notre Dame and their defense and their stud linebacker and their big stout defensive line, and that they play an SEC style, you know, type of defense. That's what they kind of aspire to. Everything that I hear accolades for Notre Dame's defense really reminds me of Georgia, you know, the stud tight end or the stud linebacker and the big defensive line and the ability to play some in the back end. I'm not saying that we're going to run on them like we did, you know, against Georgia, but I start to see where the matchups are going to be fun and exciting to watch. And I look forward to getting into their personnel and getting into their team and their season and coming back and doing, you know, maybe a couple of pregame shows.
Well, just the history of the programs for you and I to get to go to California and witness Alabama take on Texas and the tradition of those two programs. If you would have told me that in 3 years as a Bama fan, I would get to be live to witness Alabama versus Texas and Michigan and now Notre Dame. I mean, it's just a great time to be a Bama fan. And I think every Bama fan out there needs to realize that we are witnessing something pretty freaking special that will never, ever happen again in our lifetime.
Well, Tommy, you and I have been going to games. You know, it's a bigger number than maybe we'd like to say out loud, but, you know, we have, I can't think of in a 3 year span. You know, if we're gonna clock that 3 year span, I think fairly you have to include Penn State in there as well. And so,
oh, sure,
four, you know, legendary programs that we've had the opportunity to get to see us play live, you know, in person. I can't think of, you know, four equal caliber programs that we've played in the last 20 years.
Oh, sure. And speaking about this matchup for a second, I am impressed with their linebacker. I have heard the same thing you've heard. I have only watched limited film on them so far and a few nail biters that they had earlier in the year, but I've heard about their physical front seven. Their 6'6" tight end makes me nervous because of the obvious reasons of who's going to be covering him and the matchup problems that's going to create. But when you say that we just played the Georgia Bulldogs with 10 returning starters and 4 or 5 of them that will be first or second round draft picks.
Yes.
And oh, by the way, there are 2 inside defensive linemen. One runs 350 and one runs 355. I'm sorry. The fact that we just did what we did, assuming Barrett is healthy and the crutches I saw him leave the stadium with is just a minor injury, then you got to feel pretty good about this game coming up that we're going to break down.
Yeah, I do. And I'll say this. I think there is the opportunity because we know Georgia more than we know Notre Dame. And I've listened to, you know, Brian Kelly in a number of interviews, and he says things that remind me of Coach Saban. He's always talking about the little things. He's always talking about, you know, in his way, talking about a process and moving forward. He reminds me, and that's something, you know, fans, if you're listening to us, I would encourage you just to listen for. When you listen to Brian Kelly, tell me if you don't sort of get nuggets that sound like, you know, Coach Saban speak. I think there's the opportunity for Georgia to not be, you know, the whole of Georgia to not equal the sum of the parts. Whereas with Notre Dame, I think the whole is greater, potentially is greater than the sum of their parts. And so I just kind of maybe throw that out there as a tease. So when we come back with some pre-games, you know, maybe we haven't given everything away just right here, because I think there's more to Notre Dame than just saying they're not as good as Georgia and we just beat Georgia.
Sure. Well, I look forward to doing the show, man, and I look forward to taking a trip to South Beach.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Packing thongs, man.
I don't know about that, but I'm looking forward to the trip.
Absolutely. Hey, this has been another edition of the Alabama Football Podcast. Thanks for tuning in, and roll tide. Thanks for listening to the Alabama Football Podcast. We love that you're tuned in and hope that you enjoyed the show. We encourage you to reach out and let us know what you like, where we can improve, or just a shout out, a roll tide. We are where you are. iTunes, Facebook, Twitter, email newsletters, t-shirts, free roster downloads, and of course, on the web at alabamafootballpodcast.com. Check us out where you'll find easy links to your favorite way to follow the tide. Got that, Coach?
Aye.
Of course. Roll Tide.